The mother has spoken of Savitri as a supreme revelation. As such, it belongs to the class of poems known as revelatory. And by its very nature, it's a poem which cannot exactly be understood by the intellectual mind. It neither has the data nor the capacity. But revelations themselves mount from hill to hill, as the ancient seer saw. There is a plane of revelation where things are revealed as symbols. And as one climbs higher, one sees the inner lines of forces behind the symbols. Still further, the symbol is illumined by an inner meaning and sense. And then one can discover the idea force or the real idea that has built the world. Shobindo goes beyond these and brings us a little taste of all that is closed and sealed to our outward gaze. It's not just a revelation poured in the body of words and sound symbols, but it has a creative power in it, and by the mere fact of reading, Shobindo gives us a little taste of what it means to be in contact with whatever he is describing. We see it in many of his works. One example is when we read the Synthesis, and when one reads the Yoga of Divine Works, it is as if a flame of sacrifice burns through the chapters, inducing one to lead a life of consecration. When we read through the Yoga of Knowledge, we feel as if we are climbing a steep mountain, and Sri Aurobindo holds our hands and carries us from one platter to another. And again, when we read the Yoga of Divine Love, throughout the chapters, a strange sweetness, an ethereal sweetness, unearthly sweetness and joy seems to fill our being, as if the divine companion were walking by our side. All this and much more is poured in Savitri. In the series of revelations, we are with these worlds. Sri Aurobindo is taking us hand by hand, sometimes carrying us through these worlds, which have been known both in the Indian mysticism as well as European. In the Vedas, there is a description of these worlds, and so also in European mysticism, often under the name of occultism. Modern mind, especially the rational mind and the scientific mind, often rejects it, partly because it doesn't have the data. Our senses, the corporeal senses, are unable to put us in contact with them, because they can only tell us about gross things. Sri Aurobindo raises this question that why don't we know about these hidden worlds? And he gives a very beautiful answer, an answer that appeals both to common sense and logic. He says we don't know about these worlds, just as we don't know what's going on in our neighbor's mind. But it doesn't mean that the neighbor's mind, nothing is going on. There are things going on in his mind. Thoughts and feelings arise, but we are unaware. Of course, Sri Aurobindo is very generous, because frankly, we are not even aware of what's going on in our own minds. So what to speak of hidden worlds based on these sense data? The only way that one can understand it is either to start with, take them on faith and move, not stay with faith. That's the difference. Religion has stayed with faith. Religion both in the East and the West speaks of these hidden worlds, but one has to just accept it by faith. But in yoga, one moves, starts with faith, but moves from experience to experience. And as the inner senses are liberated, as the inner consciousness is liberated through the action of grace, these worlds and their contacts begins to become not only possible, but real, palpable, concrete. And as a mystic would say, more concrete than this earthly reality. That's why the yogis speak of not just one body, but many bodies. And Sri Aurobindo is just taking us on a tour of one of these bodies, the vital body, the vital world, which corresponds to the vital body of the cosmos. And in this process, he is taking us from level to level. Though Sri Aurobindo has described the heights and the depths of these worlds, their forces, their energies, and how they have influenced the earth scene, what has been their characteristic role, their action, the principle that works in them, even their beings. But he has himself put, we should not believe that when Sri Aurobindo speaks of little life and greater life and the paradise of the life gods and the descent into night, these are the only life worlds. Each of these worlds divides into several sub-worlds. In fact, it's quite possible that if one entered the life world, one would end up discovering thousands of just life worlds. And that's why mystic literature has often spoken of not just one, two, three, but many worlds. But they are built on a certain plan. And that plan, Sri Aurobindo reveals to us, is the three lower worlds of matter, life and mind, and the three higher worlds, the Satlok, the Tapolok, the Anandlok, and Link, the supramental. While Sri Aurobindo describes this, he also reveals to us the mystery of these fallen worlds. These worlds have originated from the One, and therefore each world picks up one aspect of the One, and that becomes its predominant principle, and everything else is subordinated to that. Therefore, these are typal worlds. There are only two planes where one discovers the complete truth. One, revealed completely above in the Supreme, and below in the depths of matter, because all energies, all powers, all forces find their entry into this earth. And through the evolutionary process, they are being revealed step by step. All other worlds are typal worlds. In the world of life, the principle is desire, and forms there are subservient to desire, meaning thereby what one desires, that assumes a form. That is almost like an instant action of the energy of this world, unlike the world of matter. And one would wonder, oh, it's so nice, what one desires immediately that creates, builds a form. But as Sri Aurobindo would reveal to us, that this is not what we are really seeking. And yet this world has its own place in this great and perilous and beautiful and dangerous and charming journey. In traditional yoga, as we have known in the last 1,000 years, one doesn't speak of these worlds. The reason is, if moksha, nirvana, or simply self-realization of the Advaitin kind is the goal, then really speaking, there is no need to speak about them. All that one does is to just dismiss the whole affair as the complex leela of the world which none can understand. In a sense, it's true. And if the goal is simply to escape from the lines of nature, then one should just find the shortest route from any door. It doesn't matter, any door or any window. And one need not understand the whole affair. But as Sri Aurobindo says, we are not out to escape from the world, but for a divine conquest of this world. And therefore, it is important to understand not only these worlds in their own, in their action upon us, but also in their own cosmic movement. It's important also in ordinary life. Why yoga? Because so much happens within us which is the result of a subtle transaction, as Sri Aurobindo says, an inner commerce. And because we don't know it, our life, such a beautiful line we read the other way, it brings in the incoherencies of fate. We don't understand because we don't see what is really happening inside us. So therefore, to understand these worlds is important both from a pragmatic point of view, from our earthly life, and ancient yogis, the Vedic mystics, who were very much concerned with an integral knowledge. They sought this knowledge, but they did not, they did reveal it in the language and the symbols which were pertinent to that time. Many things they hid because this knowledge can have its other side. It can be subject to misuse. But Sri Aurobindo, we are fortunate and privileged, is revealing this knowledge to us and in a language that we can receive. So we'll continue from where we left the kingdoms and godheads of the greater life. In the life world, the reigning principle is desire, and the object sought is joy and power, intensity of movement. It tries to capture that, the experience of the extremes. This is the joy of life. It tries to capture the many moods of the infinite. And that is why we see that even on earth, before life came into existence, there was material existence which we can more or less categorize in a few elements at the most. They say there are probably 108 elements that is built, and probably from the gross point of view we can say we have rivers and mountains and few things. But the moment life enters into matter, we see the whole world is filled with infinity. That is the beauty of life. It tries to recapture. As Sri Aurobindo has said, it's a child who has strayed away from its heavenly home. But it remembers what it was like when I was a little baby. And therefore it tries to recreate and capture that mood of infinity. In its own native world, it can do it with much greater freedom. But even here, life tries to capture it. And that's what is the principle of that world. Not like our world. Our world, the principle is rigidity of form and inertia. In that world, there is a much greater plasticity and freedom of movement. That world, again, because it's untouched by the mental world, it doesn't care about what we call as traditionally as virtue and vice. It seeks the hazard of the extremes, the intensity of movement, and the rapture of that movement for its own sake. So we read, we had read about just a couple of lines from yesterday, page 184. It's a beautiful line, line 404. This was transition line and starting point. A first immigration into heavenliness for all who cross into that brilliant sphere. These are the kingsmen of our earthly race. This region borders on our mortal state. As we enter into this zone of greater life, the drab pool of the earth, the sense of mortality begins to fade behind. And we begin to breathe a freer and vaster air. So this is the first immigration line, not the last. There will be many checkposts and many checkpoints Sri Aurobindo will reveal to us. But this is the first immigration when we begin to feel an unearthly sense and force move us. And then on the next page we read these lines, that how these worlds are concerned essentially with power and joy and the expansion and the intensity. And this power and joy, this sense of expansion and intensity, can be used either by the forces of evil on the lower side or the forces of good. And Sri Aurobindo says in this yoga, this too, this part, this world too must be conquered and placed at the feet of the divine for his use. Now here we have on page 185, line 436, we had read it yesterday. Whether for heaven or hell, they must wage war. Warriors of good, they serve a shining cause, or are evil's soldiers in the pay of sin. For evil and good an equal tenure keep, wherever knowledge is ignorance's twin. All powers of life towards their Godhead tend. So in these worlds, knowledge walks hand by hand with ignorance. That is why these worlds are called as fallen worlds. The worlds of the mind try to recreate the total knowledge, but by piecing up things together. And the worlds of life tries to recreate that original consciousness, its power, its joy, again, by capturing the many moods, but each mood is unique in its own right. It's not harmonized as in the one divine. In the one divine, all these moods are harmonized. Sweetness is one with strength. But here, sweetness touches its own absolute, strength its own absolute. So these are worlds where each power and potentiality tries to touch its own absolute, but isolated from the rest. So we have these few lines below on page, on the same page, 448, line 448, 449 rather. Her worshippers proclaim her sacred rite. A red, tired falsehood there ever, worship the shadow of a crooked god, admit the black idea that twists the brain, or lie with the harlot power that slays the soul. A mastering virtue statuesques the pose, or a titan passion goads to a proud unrest. At wisdom's altar they are kings and priests, or their life a sacrifice to an idol of power. And many myths and legends, especially the epics, are built around this world. The whole heroic age of mankind is about these worlds, where each character tries to reach his own peak. Any quality tries to reach its own peak. We have so many stories which have tried to capture something of this world. One story which comes instantly to mind. Yesterday we, of course, spoke of some of the stories. One of the stories where there is a king Shivi, he who in generosity goes to a point where he says, take my entire flesh, but I want to save this little dove because he has come under my shelter. So when it comes to nobility and sacrifice, they can go to any extent. When it comes to war and even laying one's life for the sake of something which one is convinced about, it can go to any extent. So this is the greater life. Not a life of daily cares and worries, our little wants and little hopes, our little anxieties and fears, but a life where there is a larger movement. So we find in the next page, 186, from the top, a charm and greatness locked in every hour. Awakes the joy which sleeps in all things made. A mighty victory or a mighty fall. When Sri Aurobindo speaks in the essays on the Gita, he says when Arjuna asks that what should I do? Should I fight or not fight? So immediately the very first answer of Sri Krishna uplifts him beyond his little thinking, his little way of looking at little things. And immediately he is reminded of a greater plane from which he is born. He say, and Sri Aurobindo puts it very beautifully, answer of a hero to a hero. Either conquer mightily or fall nobly. It doesn't matter. Either ways, the gates of heaven are open to you. Either conquer and enjoy this kingdom or die fighting a great battle. And both are worthwhile causes. In this kingdom of greater life, we have this kind of an approach. A mighty victory or a mighty fall. A throne in heaven or a pit in hell. It is not afraid of going down even into the pit of hell, if that be necessary. The dual energy they have justified and marked their souls with a tremendous seal. Whatever fate may do to them, they have earned. Now, see, Sri Aurobindo brings us in such a touch with these worlds. He gives us a little taste of this world and inspires us to live this greater life. Whatever fate may do to them, they have earned. Not like little weaklings who are always afraid of what fate may bring to us. In that world, one says, who cares? One lives the life one is born to live. Something they have done. Something they have been, they live. Look at the line. Something they have done, something they have been, they live. Their matter is soul's result and not its cause. In a contrary balance to earth's truth of things, the gross weighs less, the subtle counts for more. On inner values hangs the outer plan. Our life hangs on outer values. If somebody meets with a tragic fate, one says, oh, it was very unfortunate. In that world, that is not the value. One may live 100 years, 200 years, but a worthless life. From the point of view of the greater life, it's meaningless. But an Abhimanyu dying at the age of 16, fighting a valiant battle, falling nobly is what counts. So beings of this world feel and think like that, because that is the characteristic energy. And this is what will explain many things which appear contradictory to our eye, that of all the people during the Second World War, Shurvinder and the mother are speaking of who could be a great instrument, and they pick up Winston Churchill. If one looks at from the pure outer point of view, he is neither a very devoutly religious man as far as we know. He has certain habits and tendencies which many people would not regard as very virtuous. And yet, he has a tremendous life energy. And it is this, in fact, in one of the places Shurvinda says, that it is this tremendous and abundant life energy which often flows in wrong channel, and people call it vice. So there are two kinds of vices. One is there are beings born from this greater plane. And we spoke of this story of Hanuman. And he has tremendous life energy. And as a child, he's always busy picking up everybody's beard and troubling everyone, disturbing the class. And often the teachers have to tell him, you stay out because other monkeys cannot read, study in your presence. Because he's born with that. He's moved by the sense of largeness. He cannot be confined to a small classroom. And that would explain also many things which we don't understand about today's children, who are born with a larger prana, because the touch of the supermind is releasing a greater life inside them. Therefore, unlike their parents, our generation, which was more worried about what job they will get and what not, they just live life as if they are living life with the sense of carefree laughter of the gods. They are born with this. And only after reading Shurvinda we begin to understand the touch of these worlds. This is the passage that humanity is going through. And in this world, and in the beings of these worlds simultaneously, the walls and the boundaries are not so rigid as in our material world. When we are totally entrenched in gross matter, then we understand nothing about what's happening in another person's heart and mind. In fact, even when people say, we are so much densely into ignorance that if somebody says one sentence and we understand completely different, because ego gives it its own twist and meaning, a cause of much misunderstanding in the world. But let's see how this world interacts with each other, how the beings of this world interact. We have these lines on page, the same page, line 489. In the communion of two meeting minds, thought looked at thought and had no need of speech. One understands in this world because there is an interpenetration of substance. This is a world which is much more free, fluid. The forms of this plane are much more fluid. That's why this later on, this image of fixed gods and their fixed forms came much later. In these worlds, the same gods and goddesses or the same titan kings can appear in different forms, because the form here is plastic to the touch of the energy of this world. Emotion clasped emotion in two hearts. And that is why when human beings are moved by some touch of this world, spontaneously one begins to feel that yes, yes, I feel exactly as you feel. Of course, this world is also a world of ignorance. You must understand it. But at that point of time, the touch of this world generates this experience. They felt each other's thrill in the flesh and nerves, or melted each in each and grew immense, as when two houses burn and fire joins fire. Hate grappled hate, and love broke in on love. will wrestle with will on mind's invisible ground, others' sensations passing through like waves, left quivering the subtle body's frame, their anger rushed galloping in brute attack, a charge of trampling hooves on shaken soil. One felt another's grief invade the breast, another's joy exulting ran through the blood. Hearts could draw close through distance, voices near that spoke upon the shore of alien seas. And that is why in yoga, which it's bound to happen that after some time, our all the energies which are locked in matter begins to get liberated. And one passes through this zone. And that's a point when one becomes acutely sensitive to everything that is happening in the environment. And often, if such a person were to meet around and walk in a crowd and feel uneasy, people would wonder that yoga is supposed to make you more stable, but it's making you more unstable. But the reason is this, that one enters into a zone. This is a passage, of course, again and again Shubhendu will tell us that this is not the resting ground and one should not rest there. And that is why it's very important to have a spiritual realism and a solid grounding even in matter. Otherwise, normally we are shut in matter's wall and it's very safe. That's why two kinds of people are not affected. One who are like the sage, who have reached the transcendent heights. The other who are like stone, who are totally like matter. So they are not affected. But there is an intermediate range when one becomes more and more subtle, the consciousness becomes more and more refined. And as the mother puts it, this sensitivity which develops comes at a stage of yoga is the sign of actually an evolution of consciousness. But then one has to pass beyond. But right now Sri Aurobindo is describing that point where one felt another's grief invade the breast, another's joy exulting ran through the blood. Hearts could draw close through distance, voices near that spoke upon the shore of alien seas. There beat a throb of living interchange, being felt being even when afar, and consciousness replied to consciousness. So we expect that when this world completely, of course, this is not the world which is the new world, but this passage when much of humanity has evolved to this point, we won't need telecommunication and mobiles. And probably this was the kind of development at one stage which was actually happening, because one could directly make a reply of consciousness to consciousness. One doesn't need to speak for half an hour to communicate something. Often speaking half an hour leads to more and more confusion. That is why when in our entrance state, when we speak, the more we speak, the more we confuse, the more we misunderstand. And Sri Aurobindo is giving us a key, a master key, that well, if we try to understand, feel things from this greater life, things can be a little more simpler. And consciousness replied to consciousness. And yet, there is a yet. And yet, the ultimate oneness was not there. This is still a world of ignorance, a world of division. There was a separateness of soul from soul, an inner wall of silence could be built, an armor of conscious might protect and shield. So Sri Aurobindo is even telling us now the secret that how to really work out when we are in this phase of extreme sensitivity, which sometimes comes as our consciousness becomes refined, subtle, and begins to enter and receive some touch of these worlds. He says we can build an armor of silence and safety. An inner wall of silence could be built, an armor of conscious might protect and shield. The being could be closed in and solitary. One could remain apart in self alone. And then we can skip a few pages. Ashupati goes through these worlds and sees its many moods, myriad energies, countless facades, many, many forms appeared to his eyes, each claiming its admittance and entry. So he passes through page 191, 654, a witness overmastered by his scene. This world is captivating, and as we were sharing this yesterday, that there are many souls which can get trapped in this world. In yoga, these are mid-worlds, they are dangerous worlds because their charm can be so alluring. They can almost manufacture anything. One desires for Krishna and Krishna is there in front of the eyes. And it's so difficult, unless one has the right inner discrimination or a conscious surrender to the divine, one can easily get misled. There's a little story I heard when someone wanted to give talks on the life divine. Another dangerous profession to give talks. And he asked the mother for permission, and the mother would not reply anything. And he waited for some time, and then suddenly he had a revelation. He saw Krishna before him, and Krishna said, "Yes, yes, of course, you can." Something to the effect that you can go ahead and give talks. So he wrote that, "I have already received Sri Krishna's Adesh. And I am going to give talks." So the mother wired. "It's not Krishna you have seen. You have seen a hostile force assuming the form of Krishna." They could know all this sitting there. But of course, each one's journey, the person didn't understand, didn't get the message. Went on to give one talk, another talk, a few talks, till finally he had to just shut up and learn all that he spoke himself. So this is the kind of risk in these worlds, and we all have encountered, I'm sure, people. I have seen quite a few who keep having visions by the dozens from morning to evening, every possible god they have seen. And it doesn't make any change in their life except sometimes to puff up the vanity, because these are the worlds where desire rules. And that's why it's so necessary to purify. It's very good if for a long time one doesn't see the divine, because it means the divine has taken our consecration seriously. Otherwise, one is caught in these vital worlds without any purification, and one starts seeing things and one can easily get lost. And therefore, he allows this desire, as we will see later, it changes into an anguish. And at its height, it becomes a sob of suffering and yearning, as we find in the instance of some mystics like Mira. These are the peaks of these greater kingdoms. And then he says, "Now, child soul, you are ready to graduate into adulthood." But when, as we enter into yoga and we start from third day, fourth day, start seeing things, we must be doubly careful, triply careful. So here Ashupati describes a witness overmastered by his scene. He admired her splendid front of pomp and play. Very charming they are. And the marvels of a rich and delicate craft. If they create a Krishna in front, you can't just disbelieve that it is not the real Krishna, because every detail is there, including the seven things in the Basuri, and even the feet are like that, and even the fluting can be heard. So these worlds can create that kind of thing. And thrilled to the insistence of her cry, impassioned he bore the sorceries of her might. That's why one of the safety Sri Aurobindo gives us is, do not take the bhoga of the experience. Do not start enjoying, I experienced this, I saw this, I heard this. And worst of all, start narrating to everyone. One learns it after pain sometimes. These are not things to be spoken of. Just wait. The rishis knew how to wait and let revelation mount upon revelation. And that is why this one word, beautiful word, pregnant with so many meanings. Vladimir would be much better qualified to speak about it. But in the Upanishads, who sees the Atman? Tama atmastham yenu pashyanti dhira. Dhira. One who knows to wait, who is patient, persevering, all these shades of meaning are captured, who is stable, comes in this one word. Not one who is impatient and overeager, because these worlds give that feeling. They want us to achieve the divine in a haste, and therefore we are caught in these worlds. Impassioned, he bore the sorceries of her might, felt laid on him her abrupt, mysterious will. Her hands that need fate in their violent grasp, her touch that moves, her powers that seize and drive. But Ashwapati is not just any ordinary aspirant, so he cast his glance deep to see what is lying at the heart of this world, and he discovered something interesting. But this too he saw, her soul that wept within, because it tried and tried and tried but could not recapture the infinite. It could only create forms after forms. But this too he saw, her soul that wept within, her seekings vain that clutch at fleeting truth, her hopes whose somber gaze mates with despair, the passion that possessed her longing limbs, the trouble and rapture of her yearning breasts, her mind that toils unsatisfied with its fruits, her heart that captures not the one beloved. All else is there. We'll see that also in the kingdoms of the greater mind. Everything is there, all thoughts, formulas, theorems, yet the one is missed out. And that is why there is so much emphasis that till one has found the one who is infinite, one should not rest. The ancient yogis almost used it as a dictum. And a great mystic has said that knowing him, all else can be known. Of course, the Upanishad also speak of it. And another mystic, Eke Jane Sab Jane, it is by the one that you can know the rest, the many. And in Shobindo's yoga also, in Ashwapati, we see that first he has discovered the one. He has already finished that Vedantic yoga, and then he is discovering all the planes of the cosmic consciousness in the traveler of the worlds. So these worlds have not to be explored the way one ordinarily enters into all these kind of, especially new age techniques and all kinds of prana stuff where one picks up some vital energy and plays with it. These are very dangerous things. Especially for one who is going into yoga, because sometimes they can end up aggrandizing the ego, and one can become, instead of becoming a demigod, an instrument of the titanic will. Her seekings vain that clutch at fleeting truth, her hopes whose somber gaze mates with despair, the passion that possessed her longing limbs, the trouble and rapture of her yearning breasts, her mind that toils unsatisfied with its fruits, her heart that captures not the one beloved. Always he met a veiled and seeking force, an exiled goddess building mimic heavens. As he moved, it said, here is heaven. But as he went, something was still missing. Something was still missing. This is the kind of heavens with which Vishwamitra once built for Trishanku. When he could not get into the real heaven, Vishwamitra had tremendous power. He said, don't worry, I'll build a heaven for you. So with the power of his tapasya, he could build such heaven. And there are many such heavens which are annexes of the real worlds. Some of them created by our own thoughts and feelings. And it's so easy to get locked there. So Shobindo is telling us, always he melt a veiled and seeking force. It's only the sincerity of aspiration that can save us from all this. That's why Mother says sincerity is the key to the divine doors. If this is missing, if one is doing yoga only for power and joy and some kind of gifts like becoming a yogi or a great man, then one gets into these worlds and one is very happy. Of course, one travels around the world, earns millions of dollars, and his name is stamped in big posters. But at the end of it, one misses the one beloved. So Shobindo is guarding us that look, this can be a resting place, but not the ultimate. Always he met a veiled and seeking force, an exiled goddess building mimic heavens, a sphinx whose eyes look up to a hidden sun. This is the catch. So if one wants to expose these worlds, there is one single test one can ask. have you really found the one who hides himself behind these million forms and names? If not, the journey is not complete. So here Sri Aurobindo is telling us, this is what the story of the Sphinx is. Sphinx asks that, ultimately the question of the Sphinx is, have you found the one? Have you found the oneself who changes appearances, is one thing at morn, is another in the noon, and another at night? And if you have found, fine, you can pass through my gates toward the consciousness of immortality. This zone one must cross because the Sphinx guards it. And if not, then Sphinx ultimately devours and finishes. So it is a Sphinx that looks up to eternity. And the same truth on page 193, next page, or next to next page, line 715, Sri Aurobindo describes, reveals inner mazes of approach and of retreat. The more one enters into it, like some of those auto and taxi drivers, now of course, thankfully, things are better. But sometimes it was amazing that, it's like, to take an analogy, if somebody by chance got down at information, Auroville Information Center, and said, I want to go to Matri Mandir. It's walking distance. And if those old time auto rickshaw fellows, if you one got into it, is I'll take you. And you didn't know the way. And it took you all around Auroville, all around Pondicherry. It's just coming, sir. It's just coming. Next turn. And you realize ultimately that he brings you after 1 hour, and of course he at least brings you. But in these worlds, it keeps retreating. In her mazes of approach and of retreat, to every side she draws him and repels, but drawn too near, escapes from his embrace. And that is why Sri Aurobindo says in this yoga, the first step is to bring out the psychic. It only has the soul discrimination. All other parts, if this yoga is done by the power of the mind or the vital, this is what happens. And he says in one of his letters that one can luxuriate in experiences, one can have illuminations in the mind, one can luxuriate in siddhis of the vital, and even have astounding, remarkable siddhis in the physical. And yet, if the secret soul, the inmost soul, the psychic being has not come out, nothing worthwhile, nothing genuine has been done. So that is the safety, because otherwise in this world, if one is caught, all ways she leads him, but no way is sure. Allured by the many-toned marvel of her chant, attracted by the witchcraft of her moods. In Odysseus' travel, this world is depicted through the song of the sirens. It's so attracting, so alluring. And Odysseus is very smart. So he says, I want to hear it. If you hear it, you are captivated. You are helplessly drawn to it. So he says that, look, he tells his sailors, you guys put molten wax in your ears. I'll keep my ears open, but tie me to a pillar, and even if I cry, give orders, don't open my hands. And sure enough, as he passes through the aisle, he hears the song of the sirens and he wants to go. They are so attractive and charming. And he says, he cries, he even tells, accuses them that you people are not obeying my order. Some feel pity and melt, but this is a place where sometimes it's good to be firm. And here we have a description. Allured by the many-toned marvel of her chant, attracted by the witchcraft of her moods, and moved by her casual touch to joy and grief, he loses himself in her, but wins her not. A fugitive paradise smiles at him from her eyes. Paradise which comes and disappears, because it's not held by the one. He dreams of her beauty made forever his. He dreams of his mastery her limbs shall bear. He dreams of the magic of her breasts of bliss. In her illumined script, her fanciful translation of God's pure original text. Now here comes Sri Aurobindo's subtle sense of humor. It says that, yes, I'll tell you. You want to understand God's script? I'll tell you. It mimics even intuition. In Yoga of Savitri, this world can even mimic the stress of intuition. He thinks to read the scripture wonderful, hieratic key to unknown beatitudes. But the word of life is hidden in its crypt. The chant of life has lost its divine note. Unseen, a captive in a house of sound, the spirit lost in the splendor of a dream, listens to a thousand-voiced illusion's ode. This world captures the soul. Each world is given its own way of dealing with the soul, its nature dealing with soul in each world. In matter, the soul is held captive in its obscurity, in its rigidity and inertia. The soul in matter completely is asleep. In this world, the soul is held captive to its many moods, and it's forever listening to those thousand odes, and it must wake up. In the worlds of mind, the soul is held captive by the many, many ideas. But here Sri Aurobindo is describing us in this world, what is the relation of soul with nature? It's only in the highest world that the soul is free and nature is its slave. A delicate weft of sorcery steals the heart, or a fiery magic tints her tones and hues, yet they but wake a thrill of transient grace. A vagrant march struck by the wanderer time. They call to a brief unsatisfied delight, or wallow in ravishments of mind and sense, but miss the luminous answer of the soul. So when one takes to Sri Aurobindo's yoga, expects marvelous, miraculous experiences, but year after year one is made to do the hard work, to dig into the mud so that the base can be strong, and that time somebody comes, what are you doing here? 15 years, what have you experienced? I don't know, I just have faith in Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Oh, come, next door, there is a very nice, there is a path by which within few days you will get all this new creation stuff. Is it? Yes, transformation is very easy. And we are led into that. And we sure enough, within a week, we start experiencing all kinds of things. And if we pay little more money, the greater the experience and its value. For Samadhi, we just go so casually. Nobody asks us, of course, little bit gate pass. That's okay. I mean, timing, that also, you know, one can go, no dress code, nothing. You can put your chappals just a few feet away from the Samadhi. So unassuming. So one doesn't value. If one has to pay $100 to just visit the Samadhi, then see how many people would really get such experiences. So this is the, but Sri Aurobindo is guarding us that even this kingdom of greater life, charming, alluring, everything, it may come in the process of inner journey, but don't be caught in its sorceries, because one misses here the luminous answer of the soul. And what happens toward the end? A blind heartthrob that reaches joy through tears, a yearning towards peaks forever unreached, an ecstasy of unfulfilled desire. Track the last heavenward climbings of her voice. So they were mystics who have risen through the vital, and they are sincere. So toward these heights when they go, they begin to yearn with a deep passion and sorrow. There is a real story in the life of Meera, who used to, of course, feel Krishna and see him as intimate as anyone in his many moods. And once when she is outcast and the family has disowned and the city has disowned her, and she goes out with a little idol of Krishna. And one night, as the story goes, that idol is stolen. Perhaps on the very first night she slept. And she laments and cries, this was my only thing which I held, and you have taken even this away. So Krishna says, oh, this is the only thing? Do you know me? So she says, of course I know you. Really? And then Krishna reveals to her what he is in its truth. Till then she believed that she knew Krishna. And you see in her that pathos of the vital sometimes, yearning, that is the height towards which this can climb. It's a very high seeking, but in this yoga, that's why the seeking has to come through the psychic and not through the vital. But this too is a passage some mystics have sought. And here we find, into an old sadness's sweet escaping trail, page 194. Turned are her tears to gems of diamond pain. This is the height of this world. Because after going through it, at the end one finds one has really not found the one face hidden behind a thousand million forms. So there is a deep pathos. Her sorrow into a magic crown of song. Brief are her snatches of felicity. A lost remembrance echoes in her depths. A deathless longing is hers, a veiled self's call, a prisoner in the mortal's limiting world. Those who are born from this world, they always feel this sense of strangeness and this sense of alienness, this sense of limitation. And the more one begins to live in it, one feels more and more limited and seeks something greater. A spirit wounded by life sobs in her breast. A cherished suffering is her deepest cry. A wanderer on forlorn, despairing routes. Along the roads of sound, a frustrate voice, forsaken, cries to a forgotten place. This is its height and culminating point. And yet Sri Aurobindo says the significance of this world. This world has stood behind everything. Because its joy sustains even the suffering. Because there is ultimately even a joy in that. In this world, even suffering carries within itself an undercurrent of joy. And this makes us understand many things about life. So we have few lines below. These are marvelous lines. 770. Of course, every line is wonderful. The joy is wonderful, of course, in many ways. 770. Yet, is it joy to live and to create? This world is not to be belittled. And joy to love and labor, though all fails. And joy to seek, though all we find deceives. And all on which we lean betrays our trust. In this world, there is only a seeking, but not the finding. And yet this world has a joy even in seeking. There is a joy of seeking itself. Yet something in its depths was worth the pain. A passionate memory haunts with ecstasy's fire. Even grief has joy hidden beneath its roots. For nothing is truly vain the one has made. In our defeated hearts, God's strength survives. And victory's star still lights our desperate road. Our death is made a passage to new worlds. This to life's music gives its anthem swell. To all she lends the glory of her voice. Heaven's raptures whispers to her heart and pass. Earth's transient yearnings cry from her lips and fade. Alone the God-given hymn escapes her art that came with her from her spiritual home. So this is what yearns in its depths, and this is the safety. And ultimately, when we have passed through this world and seen its many moods, this is the hope that there is within us something that survives. Look how in the lower worlds, when Sri Aurobindo speaks of the little life, at the end he gives us hope. Again, as he comes to the close of the kingdoms and godheads of the greater life, a world which can be terribly misleading and deceiving, and yet at the end of it, he gives the hope, because even here, God inhabits. Nothing is devoid of him. And the new movement starts with, on this page 195, same page, here is the gap. Here stops or sings life's force. This starts with many, many moods, intensity, rapture, joy, power. After all its play at the end, it leaves a yearning and a suffering and a sob for missing the one. This is the essence of this world. This deficit paupers the magician's skill. It cannot take us beyond it. This want makes all the rest seem thin and bare. A half sight draws the horizon of her acts. Her depths remember what she came to do. But the mind has forgotten, or the heart mistakes. In nature's endless lines is lost the God. It can give all powers and everything, and yet something is missed out. And therefore, on page 197, Ashupati has seen its truth. Out of her deedle lines, he sought escape. He has seen the maze, this complex world, full of its charm and beauty and danger. Out of her deedle lines, he sought escape. But neither gate of horn nor ivory he found, nor postern of spiritual sight. That's why beings who are caught in this world, they never understand. Any amount of telling, it doesn't work. And this world is so misleading, as the mother would tell us, I mean, in Yoga of Savitri, Shobhinda would tell us, only through death that one can escape from this world. In ordinary circumstance, of course, unless one has the psychic discrimination, and above all, one trusts the grace, and the grace walks by the side. But if we try yoga by our own effort, this can be one of the issues very often. Out of a deedle lines he sought escape, but neither gate of horn nor ivory he found, nor postern of spiritual sight. There was no issue from that dream-like space. This is for those who wish to do yoga by their own effort and don't believe in either grace or guru or master, and who believe that, yeah, we can do everything. What is there? This is material and that is spiritual and we know it all. We now have a book and we can do it. Well, books will lead us, but here we are misled in ways that books can't help. It can mimic everything. There was no issue from that dream-like space. Our being must move eternally through time. Death helps us not. Vain is the hope to seize. A secret will compels us to endure. Our life's repose is in the infinite. It cannot end. Its end is life supreme. Death is a passage, not the goal of our walk. And we would end with these lines on page 199, where all this entire movement is summarized very beautifully. The whole seeking of life is for the one. But so long as life labors in ignorance, so long as it has not received the redeeming touch of grace, it cannot, its seeking cannot seek, and all the joys at the end cannot sum up and capture that delight. In fact, the more it tries to capture, elsewhere there are lines in this very canto, the more it held, the more it escaped. It tries to possess that one delight, but it cannot, because the only way one can really possess it by allowing it to possess itself. And in this world, one has seeking, not the finding. Many joys, but not the one delight. Many charms, but not the one face one loves. And therefore, at the end, there is a sob, a yearning, and in the depths of the yearning, a hope that he is there and one day he will redeem us. The beings and denizens of this world cry like a chained god, chained divinity, hoping for their release. So on page 199, we have these lines, 5-6 lines from below. As yearns an obscure moth to blazing light, our life is a march to a victory never won. Even in this greater life, one doesn't find, even with its greater power and force, its energies, they can give all the siddhis that we seek. Make the big small, small big, lighter heavy and heavy light. On inner value, the subtle counts for more. And yet, our life is a march to a victory never won. This wave of being longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long, far files of forward striving hopes, lift worshipping eyes to the blue void called heaven. For this world, ultimately it ends in a blue void. All the forms it has created are not the forms of the Param Drishtva. They are still only forms that come and fleet before our eyes. Looking for the golden hand that never came, this is the deep pathos of life. In fact, all our suffering in its depth is an anguish for this. And even a greater life cannot fulfill this. We often think that this little life, this anguish will cease if this greater life comes down. And always there are those who will give it to us. But even this cannot fulfill. The golden hand that never came down, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of eternity that shall appear upon the roads of time. Yet still to ourselves we say rekindling faith. If yoga is done under the stress of the higher vital, this greater world, we end up in this way, sometimes in utter despair. That's why when somebody asks the mother, would you tell us something about yoga? She says, what do you want the yoga for? It's such, so small but so deep. To gain power? To help humanity? And then she says, none of these motives is sufficient that you are ready for the path. So what is the readiness? Do you want yoga for the sake of the divine? Even the divine for the sake of the divine. Not for one of these sidekicks. These are kickbacks one expects. When kickbacks become main issue, then there is a problem. Oh, if I get the divine, then I'll become a great yogi, Superman, I will do extraordinary things. Then we end up in a trap of this world. Spiritual ambition is worse than ordinary ambition. Ordinary ambition will at most give us a crash feeling after we retire, and we can reconcile by going to a, you know, retired life ashrama, where we can live our life in peace, seeking something else which we didn't find in this life. But spiritual ambition lands up in this, and there we end up in a terrible mess. And yet, something in us, the strength of God, survives as faith. And what does it say? Yet still to ourselves we say rekindling faith, because within us there is that little spark. Oh, surely one day he shall come to our cry. These are beautiful lines, and we'll end with this. Oh, surely one day he shall come to our cry. One day he shall create our life anew and utter the magic formula of peace and bring perfection to the scheme of things. This is the throb and anguish of this world, to bring that. And this is what we must ultimately receive from this world and pass. This faith that he is there and he will bring perfection to the scheme of things. One day he shall descend to life and earth, leaving the secrecy of the eternal doors, into a world that cries to him for help, and bring the truth that sets the spirit free. The joy that is the baptism of the soul, not the joy dependent on any external charm, any external form, any experience outside, but a joy that is natural, as they say, swanta sukhai, in the self, atmarati. That joy which is the very nature of the self, the joy that is the baptism of the soul. It doesn't have to seek it in this or that experience. The strength that is the outstretched arm of love, not love that is weak, incapable, not love that is only sweetness, but love that is strong to rescue us out of the bonds of ignorance. That love one doesn't find in this, that love can only come from the heights. But the problem is we don't recognize that love, because when it pulls us out of all this maze, we cry, what kind, how cruel are you? What a torturing hand is this, which is taking away from me all that I cherish and desire. This world, on the contrary, whatever we cherish and desire, it presents to us. And we like this kind of God. So we like a God who is more like a being of the greater life, who fulfills our desire, and everything that we desire, he presents to us. And if he can present us with quickness, from house to wealth to health, we like that God. but not that love which is the not that love whose arm is strength, which pulls us out of ignorance, sometimes with firm arms, taking away all that we cherish and hope and desire. We don't like that God. But here, something in us cries for that. The strength that is the outstretched arm of love. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil. He has deliberately worn this dreadful veil, this little life, this darkness, this obscurity. Because, or even sometimes a beautiful spell. But all this because of a great purpose that it serves. One day he will lift it. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil, impose delight on the world's beating heart, and bear his secret body of light and bliss. But now we strain to reach an unknown goal. In this world, one strains. There is no end of seeking and of birth. There is no end of dying and return. The life that wins its aim asks greater aims. The life that fails and dies must live again. It is there in life because there is a joy in everything. And this cannot cease till it has found the one. This, at the end of all these worlds, Sri Aurobindo will reveal to us the hope. He rekindles hope and faith and shows us the meaning and purpose of the journey. The life that wins its aim asks greater aims. The life that fails and dies must live again. Till it has found itself, it cannot cease. All must be done for which life and death were made. I think we will stop here. And in February, we will continue with Mother holding us in her arms of love and strength. We will descend into the night. Thank you.